Egypt wants a communications blackout as anti-government protests there heat up.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Good morning from American Public Media in New York. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Internet and cell phone service has been disrupted across Egypt today as the ruling government there tries to tamp down on anti-government protests. David Butter at the Economist Intelligence Unit says shutting down the communications in Egypt is not as hard as it sounds.
The whole telecommunications sector in Egypt still has a fair amount of state control over it. And so I think that it probably is not that difficult for people in the intelligence services or the police to hand out instructions to the relevant engineers at the various choke points.
The British telecom company Vodafone was asked this morning to suspend mobile services in parts of the country and said it will comply with the order. Well, in about a half hour, we'll hear from the U.S. government on how fast the economy here grew last quarter. Marketplace's Elisa Roth gives us an idea of how we can interpret the latest numbers on gross domestic product.
GDP can be too high or it can be too low. And like a lot of economic indicators, it's partly relative. That is, we compare the number now to the last quarter, to last year. Karen Petru is at Federal Financial Analytics, a research firm. She says there are some general guidelines, though.
In a mature economy, the GDP growth, 5-6%, is frankly as high as it should go without starting to run the danger of bubbles and inflation.
In an emerging economy that's still growing, like China, for example, it can go a lot higher. She says after that, you run the risk of overheating. She says during the recession, we had a GDP of about zero. Anything above that is good news.
Positive GDP growth means we're coming out of the hole. And it means we will have employment gains.
But she says the housing market still needs to pick up for us to see really solid numbers. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
In Norway today, countries that border the Arctic Circle are wrapping up a development conference. They say melting ice means more ships can use Arctic waters. But as Eve Tro reports from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, that's not so easy.
Sending ships across the Arctic is a long-standing dream in the shipping industry. Joe Keefe with the Maritime Reporter says four commercial vessels made it across the Arctic last year, more than ever before.
Saved their companies thousands of miles of transit times compared to going around the Horn and through one of the canals.
But he says those were experimental voyages, and transarctic shipping should stay that way for now, because systems aren't ready.
Training people to do things like navigate through ice. There's very few people that actually know how to do that.
Keefe says more companies are training for polar conditions. David Balton with the U.S. State Department says major shipping across the Arctic is many years away. Because even with historic amounts of ice melting, the Arctic is still only passable in the short summer.
It costs a great deal of money to retrofit boats to sail all the way through icy waters only for a few weeks a year.
He says companies don't have polar fleets that could, say, take wheat from the U.S. to China yet. But as more ice melts each year, that is where things are headed. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mixed around the globe right now. Ford said this morning it earned its highest profit in more than a decade last year thanks to a pickup in truck sales. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow gained just 4 points to close at 11,989.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733.
Christie's Auction House is reporting sales of $5.2 billion for last year, marking the best year in the company's 245-year history. That's in part thanks to strong sales of Impressionist and modern art. That's good for Christie's, but for the people who make their living making visual art, here's a story of a serious workplace hazard. Many art supplies contain lead and other dangerous compounds, as Tanya Ott reports.
Larry Stevens shakes a can of spray paint, then starts applying it to a canvas. Stevens paints professionally under the name Sinister. He sells his work in galleries in Michigan and California. Most of the time, he paints outside, But in winter, he's indoors wearing a respirator or a dust mask. It's not enough.
You know, within a couple of hours, you know, I'll start getting dizzy and, you know, you'll end up coughing up paint the next morning. And if you'll go to blow your nose and it'll be green and red and yellow and whatever colors you were using that day.
Experts say there are no large-scale health studies of people who use art supplies. But Dr. Stephen Marcus, who is New Jersey's poison control chief, says lead, arsenic, and cadmium are found in some paint pigments. And some glues and cements contain chemicals that can cause neurological damage. In one condition, called wrist drop, sufferers actually lose strength in their hands.
For an artist, that's their bread and butter. They lose strength in their hands and they can't be an artist.
Most art supplies come with warnings, like using proper ventilation. But Marcus says they don't really define proper. And then consider that some artists live and work in the same building.
You know, you can't wear the respirator 24/7.
Artist Larry Stevens knows this too well. About a year ago, doctors found a spot on his lung. He doesn't know if it's cancer because he hasn't had any follow-up tests. He says he can't afford health insurance.
It's just not in the cards right now. You know, I'm not going to go in debt for a spot on my lung that could be something or it might not be.
In the meantime, the U.S. Senate is considering legislation to update the Toxic Substances Control Act. That might help professional artists and hobbyists get a better picture on the true dangers they could face. I'm Tanya Ott for Marketplace.
And finally, a tennis match tomorrow at the Australian Open will be a first. It'll be the first time a player from China competes in a Grand Slam singles final. 28-year-old Li Na has become a sensation in China. She was asked what motivated her to get through one of the sets that got her to this point. Her answer? Prize money. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
A lot of banks offer pretty much the same product. So how does a smaller bank compete? Well, how about free lattes and Wi-Fi and goods from local stores?
What we want our people to think is, I'm going to go to the bank store and browse, shop. And by the way, while I'm there, I might cash a check and make a deposit.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, a bank where everybody knows your name. Next time on Marketplace, we'll have the numbers from Wall Street for you as well. It's from American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.